flavour.
This is Cambridge Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
So we get better flavour because of the fen soil.
I've drunk more beer since I came here and bought my two barrels than I've ever done in my life before, I think.
I shouldn't have said almonds. They don't make it from almonds.
So you've got this big sticky mess when you start off.
Pizza pots, pies.
My wife's cakes are selling up hotcakes. Brilliant, thank you.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Cambridge.
Good afternoon and welcome to the first flavour of 2025. We're looking forward to what the new year will bring, the new restaurants and coffee shops that will open, the new independent producers which will emerge, and the new food trends that will be developed. Whatever happens, flavour will be hot on the trail throughout the year. And today, we're going to look back at what happened in 2024, along with all our usual features, of course. So in the studio today, we've got Alan Alder and myself, Matt Bentman. Sadly, Sue Bailey can't be with us, though.
The Cambridge area food scene has such a lot going for it. Not only are there nationally recognised restaurants, excellent coffee shops and coffee roasteries, there are outstanding independent food shops and a good market too. And there's a plethora of local bakeries and some home bakeries.
Yeah, also excellent local breweries, wine cellars, even winemakers, and there's outstanding innovators too, like Steve Thompson, the foraging chef. We're going to squeeze as many of them into today's programme as we can.
There are outstanding food writers too, Tim Hayward, B. Wilson MBE, as she now is, and Rosie Sykes. Flavour has covered some of their writing during 2024, and we'll begin our look back with Tim Hayward and an extract from an extended interview we did with him on the 15th of June about his book Steak, The Whole Story, in which he looks at all aspects of steak, including some extraordinary bits of steak history. In this extract, Tim talks about the monkey gland steak.
So the story of the monkey gland steak is around the 1920s. There was a lot of interest in sort of quasi-quack science. And there was one particular Russian doctor who discovered that, well, I don't think he'd even never really sort of proved it, but he got very successful, particularly around Los Angeles, in transplanting slices of monkeys' testicles into the testicles of men, that they might become more virile, I believe was the assumption, and it was kind of proto Viagra, and I think I think it's quite possible that, I mean, as a man who, as yourself, is challenged in the hair department, will be aware of our contemporaries and how awfully they behaved in chasing anything that would conceal their male pattern baldness, and I think when it comes to erectile dysfunction. And that's the first time that will have been mentioned on a food programme, I think, ever. In the history of erectile dysfunction, has been far, far worse. So there were men in Hollywood who were perfectly happily having their testicles laid bare, slashed open and slices of monkey gland inserted to, give themselves the correct responses. And it became quite the story. And there are lines in sort of Noel Coward songs about monkey glands. And they started administering monkey glands to women who believed that they obviously didn't insert them in that way, but they always believed that it was an elixir of youth. And it became really quite crazy. Everyone was obsessed with monkey glands.
Right.
And a monkey gland steak was just a marketing exercise. So one of the restaurants, probably Delmonico's or the Brand Derby or something like that, said, no, we do a monkey gland steak. And all it was a steak, deglazed table side with lots of brandy, which is alcohol, which is good for your bits, and mustard and chili powder and all that sort of nonsense and some pickles. And it was fiery and exciting and invigorating. And, as if you're in this 1920 and you're taking a starlet out for a date, and you order a monkey gland steak with a twinkle in your eye, I dare say it's a fine thing. It's not popular anywhere in the world now except South Africa.
Another local chef, Rosie Sykes, had a book out too, and it was called One Last Bite. Now, one of the aims of the book is to help people reduce food waste by suggesting ways of using leftover food. And if you want to hear Rosie talk about the book again, it's in our programme dated the 10th of February, which is available, of course, as a podcast.
And avoiding waste is very much a concern of Flavour. So, on all our programmes, we feature updates from Olio, the phone app that uses your location to tell you of all the free food available near you. There's no strings attached. It's designed simply to stop food reaching its sell-by date from going to waste. Many people have taken Olio to heart, including this local lady who regularly collects vast quantities of food from the supermarkets to distribute to those in need.
In a way, it's sad to see a city that is so wealthy, to have people here who have got hardly anything.
I was reading the news yesterday, and there was an article about firefighters and nurses, for example, that were living in their cars and vans in Cambridge because they can't afford the cost of living in this town to do their jobs, essential jobs.
But you look at the prices now just of having a room. It's horrendous.
Yes.
If you look, it's a lot of international companies and so on. So you have got these guys with huge salaries and they really push up the prices of the flats and so on.
Yeah.
That's why if I have sandwiches left over at night, I collect them all and I put them in the car and I take it to A&E for the doctors and the nurses there.
Even doctors?
And of course, because they don't have any open shops up there, so they're very grateful.
Yeah, their shops just close at times that, like normal shops close.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there isn't anywhere where they can buy any food. Mm. So they're really happy to receive it.
So Olio can help all sorts of people. Do you get a lot of students?
Yes, mostly international students, actually. And they live in a sort of house share. And there are seven or eight of them. So they come and say, we're seven people sharing the house. Can we have some pastries? Because they find it very difficult. And I had local students as well, and they said, we just don't have the money to buy meat. Also, I get a lot of vegetarian and vegan stuff. Mm. And I've got two or three students that are just absolutely delighted to get it because they can't afford it, because they are so expensive, the vegan stuff. I have six sausages in around about £4, £5.
Yeah.
And that's an awful lot of money for a student. There are people out there who need it. And in a way, it makes me very sad to think that there are people who are desperate. And it's really important that these things happen, that we share and that we are open with each other and help each other out.
It's a good time to check up on what free food is available in and around Cambridge right now. So, what is on Olio today, Matt?
Well, first up, we've got Eugenie on Abraham Road, who has lots of baguettes and batons, a selection of pastries and loaves, as well as Bakewell slices and flapjacks to give away. Tim in Milton has a bag of baking potatoes available, whilst Tom in King's Hedges is also offering plenty of baguettes and pastries. But that's it from Olio in Cambridge today. Maybe it's the intense cold that's putting people off.
And don't miss out on the other app called Too Good To Go, which has unsold food from restaurants, cafes and shops, often at less than half price. It's used by a huge number of local shops, hotels, coffee shops and others to avoid their unsold food being binned.
Well, returning to our look back at 2024, there are a lot of food producers whose products we admired. One is local baker Jennifer Marshall of Sourdough Hub. Now, Jennifer was an international concert pianist based in Malta. She gave up her career to look after her children, and she set up a baking business in Malta because she didn't like the amount of chemicals in the local bread. Now, when she moved to Newmarket, she wanted to continue baking, but she had to find suitable outlets for her products. In our 24th of February edition, Jennifer talks to Sue Bailey about how she got going here.
What I did is I just basically cold called people, because what else do you do? You know nobody. I had no friends right here. So what I did is told myself, how did I start in Malta? How did I do it? You know, and the only way I could think of is start from my street. So we happen to live at the moment in Newmarket, and I was thinking of the next coffee shop that is the next in the next street down from the house. So I cold called Victoria from Newmarket. Cold called her. She gave me the first window of hope. She said, let's meet. And then she said, what do you do? I said, well, I can do breads, I can do donuts, I can do, you know, I sort of started listening. And she said, She said, I already have a supplier who does breads, and I feel that I like loyalty. So good for her. I think that's very important. She said, but I have nobody doing donuts. She said, would you bring me some to try? So I did. We did that. And the following week, she ordered 20, and they were sold out within an hour.
Excellent.
That's how my relationship started with her, and it's been going on since March 2023. And in fact, she just opened her second coffee shop in Sawston, and she's ordering now not twice, but almost three times the normal amount, you know. So it's about building relationships, and the only way to do it for me is to prove my point, to prove what I can do, to give my the best, to be trustworthy, and to use top ingredients as well as I can. I try not to buy an ingredient. I try to make everything myself. All my fillings I make, I try to use organic flours if possible, and so on. But to give the best that I can, because I want people to trust me, you know, and that's the only way I can build bridges for me, because I don't have a history here. In Malta, I built that history, and that's why perhaps people still contact me. Whereas here, I have to start cold.
But again, you're building a history here, because I gather you're supplying people again in Cambridge. Which places are you supplying at the moment?
So at the moment, we're doing filled focaccias, caprese focaccias, for the new coffee shop called London Great Coffee. So they just opened one in Regent Street in Cambridge. So we're doing, I do the focaccias and I fill them with mozzarella, pesto, tomatoes, and we're doing sort of now double the caprese. The caprese seem to be doing really well. I work with the coffee shop on West Road called Harvey's at Gonville and Keys, and that is so popular. It's incredible. So they order donuts every day from me.
London Great Coffee in Regent Street has closed down now, but Harvey's is thriving, and Jennifer's Bakery in Newmarket is next open on the 18th and then the 25th of January from 9 until 12 noon.
Another local is Spencer Drake. Now, he's an instructor who helps locals produce honey. His enthusiasm is sure to get you buzzing.
There's nothing better than standing over a hive when the honey is flowing, having that waft up to you. It gets into you. It gets into your blood in some ways. I've got here some wax in my very pocket, because as beekeepers are, they typically carry this sort of stuff around. If you want to give it a smell, it's waxy, sort of beeswax smell. Beekeeping on a day-to-day basis, you could think of it as a smelling experience, a tasting experience. You're always working with the wax, the wood smoke from your smoker. And all of that combines over time to create the most delightful scents that you're always working with in the summer. My bee suit smells of it after years of working, even out of season. I put it on, as I have today, and that smell brings me back. And that all comes through in the final reward. The actual honey itself is the amalgamation of all of that work you've done, all of the work of the bees, all of you working together, put into a fantastically tasting form.
You know, and as a beekeeper, Spencer knows which side his bread is buttered and honeyed. Is beekeeping bad? You're farming them, you're taking their end product, and they clearly get angry about it.
If it's done incorrectly, yes. I agree, absolutely. It's incredibly important that the bees come first, before your needs for a honey crop, for so many jars per year, for so much profit. You can prioritize them. You understand what strains are put on the hive, what local conditions are negative for bees, how to work with them properly to keep them relaxed, to keep them happy. It's easy to see when a hive is doing well, when they are happy to some degree. Although, of course, they have very different emotional registers than we do. That's the core of things. It's not about the honey so much as the well-being of the bees themselves. Globalized beekeeping has brought in so many parasites, so many diseases that ravage wild bees year on year on year. And that's why the wild bee species, the non-honeybee species of the UK, are struggling, as well as, you know, increased industrial farming, for instance, the cutting back of wildlands.
Beekeeping can be an incredible passion, and even at the beginning of the year is a good time to take it up. Spencer has incredible knowledge and skill, and he's an advisor to the Royal Family's apiaries. He can be contacted for tutorship at spencerldrake@hotmail.com. So, like John Lennon said, maybe you should give bees a chance.
Oh. One culinary use for honey is in the making of biscuits. And Rosie Sykes has a Friday biscuit recipe on her Instagram site. Here she is from the 18th of May talking about them and when it all started.
You've been doing, I think it was over lockdown, wasn't it? You started doing on Instagram a Friday biscuit, and you've recently restarted.
It's really nice to see how happy people are to see it come back, actually. And we're still in the early days, and we're going to create a few more and revisit a lot of them. So one of the most popular biscuits, actually, is one that Lucy, my friend, who created... who came up with the idea for the Friday biscuit after our walks together. She's in marketing, so she's very smart. But she created a biscuit which I renamed Biscotti di Tutti, because it is a home for all the little bits of your little packets of dried fruit that are left, or a nut or two, or some oats, or some other cereal, or all sorts of things are thrown into this biscuit. But its main component is oats. So it sort of feels quite healthy, totally delicious, really lovely. And that has had a lot of likes.
Alan discovered some good local baking on a trip to Cambridge Market when he went to the Market Square coffee and cake stall. This is from our programme on the 20th of April.
We started doing it in February when we came back from our winter break. Yeah, it's our newest cake. The first week we brought out one cake. And it did really well. And then the next week, so we did two. And then up until now, we are now doing four every weekend. We're only here for 2 days a week.
So yeah.
On the Friday and Saturday. We couldn't have imagined it going better, really. It's got a good following.
Right. Well, I must say, I had some a couple of weeks ago, about a month ago, actually, and I'm not normally a fan of cheesecake, but it is. There's something different about
there
it.
There is, yes. It's not like your traditional cheesecake with the biscuit base. It has no biscuit base, and it's a lot creamier.
I think that's probably what I liked about it.
It's got a kind of like sourness to it, because we use cream cheese in it. Sour cream in it. So it gives it a bit of a... kind of a nice bite to it.
And also you get a good size, you get a good amount of it.
You do, yes. You get a good portion size. As most of our cakes on this,
becoming a fashion really.
Yes, it has. I tried it recently last year, probably in London I think it was, and I loved it. It has got a bit of a following, so I thought I'd give it a go. It's gone from strength to strength.
I'm not surprised, actually.
And that's the burnt Basque cheesecake we were talking about. Scott and Claire's stall will return to Cambridge Market on the 7th of February. And I discovered more good local baking when I spoke to Hannah Hoskins of Munro Street Bakers, based in Newnham, on 14th of December. Hannah has returned to Cambridge after some years in Washington, D.C., which is where Munro Street is, and her baking has a mix of both British and American styles.
I was looking at some of the things that you do, and I was wondering what a Mexican wedding cake was.
A Mexican wedding cookie. They're a little walnut. They're like a tiny buttery shortbread, and they're really filled with nuts and sugar. And you dust them with icing sugar when they're still hot, so it has that kind of melted, vanilla-y, nutty flavour. I'll bring you some next time.
Once we're out of the Christmas period, what sort of things will you be doing then?
So I always have on my website available like a steady state of things, various birthday cakes, and I'm always happy to take custom orders for... I'm doing a tiramisu for someone this weekend, for example, so stuff like that I'm always happy to do. And then, cookies, kids' birthday stuff, breakfast things I love doing, but I know there is Maison Clément right around the corner, like American-style scones. Got some scones on there which are not a traditional British scone, for sure.
Oh, aren't they? In what way?
They are not fulfilling with cream and jam. In the States, you have them with your coffee, just a little buttery, flaky treat in the morning,
So they don't have sultanas or currants or whatever?
Yeah, so the ones I'm doing at the moment, I think I have a cranberry and orange one up and a double chocolate one.
And going back from...
Also happy to make a regular scone whenever anyone wants.
Right. So you do requests. So.
Yeah, I do requests. I take requests, basically.
Right, we'll break away from looking back at 2024 now and have our first news break for the 11th of January, 2025. And over there in Congratulations Corner is Bea Wilson, who has been awarded an MBE for services to food writing and food education. So many congratulations, Bea, and well deserved.
Wee Vinoteca at Burwash Manor has closed. The owner, Duncan Gammy, said he loves the hybrid wine shop wine bar model, but that it wasn't possible in the space that he had. However, he says he will be back in the area as soon as he finds a suitable location.
Cam's Cuisine has £10 off meals in January. You can download a voucher from the Cam's Cuisine website.
The Cherry Pit has opened in King Street. It offers coffees, pies and vinyl. Tuesdays to Saturdays, 9.30 to 4.30.
Parker's Tavern has a wine and food evening on the 16th of January at 6pm with Bert Blaze from North Norfolk Cellars and author of Which Wine When? And A Winemaker's Guide to Drinking the World. There will be four wines to try alongside a menu created by Chef Lee Clark and tickets are £30.
Pages has a coffee cupping evening with Change Coffee Roasters. This will be an hour long. It includes a tasting of all their current beans and there will be a chance to ask coffee-related questions. Tickets for this are free, but places are limited, so booking is required. This is on the 19th of January at 5pm.
Finboys is having a French bistro night on the 27th of January. There are five courses that include meat dishes, such as rabbit pâté with tarragon and coq au vin with potato puree. And there will be a selection of French wines too. It's £50 per person. On the 5th of February, there's a Napa versus Sonoma wine dinner where the wines will be matched with fish dishes. You'll need to join a waiting list for this one. And on the 16th of February at Finboys, there's a Sunday lunch pop-up with sea trout Wellington and a selection of starters including oysters, sashimi and some cheeses. And that's £50 too. That's the news for now. More later.
Meanwhile, back in 2024, Sue discovered the marvels of Kitch Hen, who make Scotch eggs, but not any old Scotch egg.
It may sound a little quirky, but it's one of these that if you try it, people tend to buy it. So it's coronation chicken. So I'll roast the chicken and then reduce all the stock down, put that in the mix, and then obviously add mango chutney, etc. So you eat it cold and it's a really good picnic egg. Mm. I really like that one. New today, we haven't done this for a while, we've got fish pie.
Love these ideas.
Well, that's a really great one to pop in the oven, obviously, to warm up. We have several veggie options that are cheese-based, actually, and if you put them in the oven, they're really good, because if, like, the three cheese dauphinoises with the...
Oh, that sounds too good.
So it's dauphinoise potato and three cheese, and when it melts, it just you just loosen it up a bit, and the mozzarella will start stringing out. Mm. And we've got mac and cheese, and then the arancini, a sort of scorched pepper, sunblushed tomato risotto with mozzarella at the centre for those who don't like eggs.
Oh, wow.
But that, yeah.
Oh, that's really clever for the vegetarians amongst us.
We do have plant-based sausage rolls, but not today, unfortunately. We've got some of our smarter, fancier eggs today. We've got lamb harissa, slow-cooked lamb with harissa spices and black cherry, pastrami with Emmental and sauerkraut, which is popular, but I have to say, wouldn't you agree, boys, that the most popular egg is...
Traditional.
The traditional.
Yeah, traditional.
And the tray is entirely empty.
Yep, yep, they're always the first to go.
And you've got an Indian one, I see, up at the end.
Yep. So I cook the onions for about 6 hours in 12 spices. Then it's whole chickpeas, potato, rice, fresh coriander, and coconut cream. And then we roll it in Bombay mix before we fry it. So it's a nice crunch. And then you get the peanuts, which brings out the sweetness in the egg. And I just think it works really well.
Wow.
I think the first one, other than doing traditional, the first kind of fancy egg, as it were, was kedgeree, because I had some left over. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. You have poached egg with kedgeree. Why not? And so...
Put the kedgeree around the egg, yeah.
And then it started and really...
Went on from there.
Give me a shoe and I'll try and crumb it.
Yeah.
It's great fun.
That was Esther Bickerton of Kitch Hen. Now, in 2024, we covered not only the foods, but the wines to enjoy with them. I visited Bacchanalia, which has sold wine and beer from its two shops in Cambridge for almost the last 30 years. Now, I had to include this in my choices for this year because the owner, Paul Bowes, is great, and he and his shop embody that perfect Cambridge indie spirit.
How many bottles do you think are in here?
Oh, pfft. Individual bottles?
Yeah.
So as in facings, type of wine. 500 is my best guess. All the wines that we've got are our shop favourites. So that's when people say, what's your favourites? And people say, oh, have you tried all the wines? They say, well, of course I have, because I wouldn't sell anything that I didn't know how it tasted.
So you're kind of, you're stocking an impeccable cupboard. You know, you sound like you've got a lot of people's dream job here, because you live above the shop,
And behind the shop as well. My wife would tell me after, I didn't tell you. It's a nice house, and this is our front couple of rooms.
Yeah. Minimal transport costs.
Absolutely. Well, that door there, that's my commute.
Some of them give me a heart attack because I can see the bottles just tipping out over the edge. You know, like with those machines where you drop the two peas in and they...
Yeah.
That's what it looks like here, but they're all safe, of
course.
They're
all safe. Very rarely do we get a breakage, and we're not slapdash, but I think maybe I'll push that one back a little bit. No, Grant. If a bottle does go, you get very adept at trapping it like a football on the top of your foot to take the old energy out of it. Luckily, we've got a wooden floor. 19 times out of 20, they bounce.
The time I spent with Paul that evening, it was really obvious to see how he still loves dealing with the customers, he loves the banter, he loves the sell. And that's not just because we had the microphone on him.
Pairing wines with food has been a big feature on Flavour. Duncan Gammy of Wee Vinoteca gave some very helpful tips throughout the year. And here, Chong Chong Bo talks about cheese and wine pairings. And this is from the 10th of August.
Little bit of a generalisation, but you wouldn't pair the same wine with a fresh, young, acidic goat cheese, for instance, compared with an extra mature Comté. Those would have quite different pairings. So I'm keen to explore the different groupings of wines that would go with each category of cheese. The more pungent a cheese is, the more strong the flavours are, the stronger the wine that you can choose to pair with it. Generally, very strong-bodied red wines just don't work with those soft, fresh cheeses. It's a bit of a clash, and...
And that was Chong Chong Bo. We're off for a couple of minutes now. See you with more from 24 after the break. Don't go away.
Cambridge Radio podcasts tell the story of our city and the people who live here. Debate the issues that matter to you with CAMS Politics.
If we really want to support the government's ambition for growth, we can't do it here just in Cambridge. We have to partner with other cities.
Follow your local teams in From the Terraces.
With the right partner, perhaps he has got the potential to do some damage, but he looks a little bit like a lost sheep to me. He doesn't kind of fit the pattern of United's play.
Get your cultural fix in Cambridge Arts Roundup.
One of the things that's been interesting is to figure out different strategies to display my own work, but also figure out strategies to just rehang existing paintings.
Listen to your favourite Cambridge podcast on Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
Catch up with your favourite shows online.
Go to cambridge.radio and look for On Demand.
Welcome back to Flavour and our review of 2024. So, we're going to return to food producers for a bit. And Sue was an enthusiastic convert to Korean-style corn dogs. This is from our programme of the 27th of July when she visited the Mana Seoul food van.
The Korean street food that we do, we've brought the... it's essentially corn dogs, fried chicken and a kimchi-loaded fries. There are kind of three, I guess, kind of staple menu items. The corn dogs are essentially an American thing, and the Koreans, this is going back maybe 40, 50 years, put their spin on it. And personally, I don't like American corn dogs, but as soon as I tried the Korean corn dogs, I thought they were exceptionally good. They're not that well known in the UK. I think you can get them in a few places in London, Bunsick, and I think some place in Camden Market. So we just decided to do something, slightly original. You know, we knew if we'd set up another burger or another pizza van, I just don't think it would have gone down so well. I don't think there's enough space for potentially that. So yeah, we just wanted to bring sort of some of Lan's kind of childhood favourites. You know, as I say, she grew up with corn dogs, and the Koreans absolutely love fried chicken. I mean, I think a lot of people think that, oh, you know, why would Koreans like fried chicken? But if you go to Korea, they are absolutely nuts about fried chicken.
But so a corn dog, I mean, I've never had an American corn dog. Yeah. So a Korean corn dog, I gather it's a donut base?
So
it sounds weird.
No. So the American corn dog, I actually don't essentially know what the corn dog is made of, maybe a cornmeal or something. But the Korean corn dogs are a flour dough, and the texture would be, I wouldn't say it's like a pizza, it's more of a donut. It's like a donut texture. It's chewy, crunchy exterior. It's not greasy, you know, and inside, well, in ours, you can either have full sausage. So we use like a Dino's Big Dog Frankfurter, which is, well, they've won like a taste award. So we tried many Frankfurters, you know, because we wanted to get the right ones. So you can have Frankfurter, mozzarella and Frankfurter, which is called a half and half, or full mozzarella, which is the full mozzarella, and then you can get all sorts of variations. You know, we do a bacon and maple syrup one, we do a sweet potato one or a potato version. So wow. I mean, it's endless. I mean, we do a chocolate one as well,
and you have little studs of the potato in the outside of it. This looks incredible.
It looks like a club, like almost some sort of weapon, like a barbarian's club. That's what it looks like. You know, I think it appeals to all ages. Obviously, the kids know about it. They've seen it on TikTok and they love it. But I think, obviously, we don't just want to be seen as like a van for kids, because it isn't.
Food producers depend on the quality of ingredients, and that's been another important focus of flavour. Tim Hayward, who we heard from earlier, strongly recommended the meat produced by the Wandering Herds beef cattle, which wander across the many pastures in and around Cambridge. Their primary function is environmental. The cattle help to maintain the flower meadows they live on, and being a hardy breed, they do it all year round. Here is farmer Ben Womwell talking to me on his way to Trumpington Meadows, where some of the cattle were grazing in the late summer sun on the 5th of October. So they have a nice life, Ed. And what's the meat like? I know Tim Hayward speaks very highly of it.
Yeah, no, Tim's been a huge support and really opened our eyes to it. The primary aim for us was always conservation grazing, but to be able to sustain that, obviously meat had to come into the equation. I think we always knew it was going to be good. You know, they have a fantastic diet on all these wildflowers and wild grasses on our nature reserves. But that's what we were, conservation graziers, not salesmen. So to have, you know, the feedback from our first batch been overwhelming, really. It kind of, I suppose, it makes sense to us once. We'd eaten it ourselves. It was incredible. The feedback from everyone has been fantastic, because they are, as I say, eating all this huge variety of the wildflowers.
And all the year round as well.
All year round. Yeah. As I say, there's no handling yards, no extra compound feeds or anything like that. It's very, very natural.
You can get on the mailing list for the Wandering Herds beef boxes by sending a direct message with your email address via Instagram, and that way you'll know when the boxes are available and how to order.
Now, locally produced food is also available from Darwin Nursery, and that's where I went for the programme on the 2nd of November. The Darwin Nursery and Farm Shop is a really great place to get your fruit and veg. You're free to walk the 7.5-acre site, and there's a cafe too. This is an NHS project. It provides work for people with learning disabilities and neurodiversities, such as autism and ADHD. Here's team manager Sandy Kane.
Everybody's different, and so we get to know the people that work here and work with each person as an individual to encourage them to grow in the way that suits them the best.
Yeah. So as well as having polytunnels, an orchard, a cafe, fields and grounds to relax in, they've also got animals.
Hello, beauty.
It's Lorenzo. Yeah, they sort of sing to you when you come in the morning. They really love a cuddle, and if you catch them right, they'll lay on their back and show you their belly for a belly rub.
Lorenzo, Wilbur and Dave are Cooney Cooney pigs from New Zealand.
They're chosen because they are very loving and friendly animals. The reason why it's so therapeutic for the co-workers is if you're a looked-after person all of your life, to look after something else gives you compassion and understanding of what's required. Also, you have to be mindful when you're with animals. You can't be in your head worrying about things. You have to be present, and that's a really good experience for people. It's a great relationship to build, a loving relationship with an animal with no issues or problems. All of those things are really important to the people that we work with. Yeah.
goats, sheep, chickens, ducks, pigs, and stacks of homegrown fruit and veg, and cakes. You can find the Darwin Nursery and Farm Shop on Newmarket Road between the Airports Way roundabout and Junction 35 of the A14.
And more news now. Pudini of William has a hidden supper club on the 31st of January and a Valentine's supper club on the 14th of February.
Market House in Market Square has a Lunar New Year celebration. That's from the 28th to the 31st of January. You can celebrate the Year of the Snake with a tasting menu that includes vegetable spring rolls, sweet and sour sea bream, roast duck bao buns, and sticky rice cake. And the cost for this is £48. And on the 26th of February at Market House, there is a Famille Perrin wine dinner. Each course has a matching wine. The cost for that is £105.
Kirsten Horn of the Gwydir Street Supper Club has announced the menu for his 22nd of February event, and that's a Jamaican night. The cost is £55 and it's a bring-your-own-bottle arrangement, though there will be a complimentary peanut punch. And that's the news for today.
OK, now, another of Sue Bailey's discoveries last year was the food at Triplo's Green Man. She was very struck by it and discovered that head chef Danny Hill has a unique approach to getting the flavours right.
Your food is something else. It's gorgeous. The flavours are amazing.
I don't think enough people, when they look at a recipe, they don't follow the flavour side of the recipe. It's just because the recipe says put X amount of cinnamon in. Depends on the cinnamon you're using. I used to go January, February when I had golf club franchises, I'd go away to Turkey or Morocco and go on little buying trips. So the cinnamon I was buying in Turkey, the stuff you are getting from these specialist sort of areas, and you go into these spice markets where there's piles of spice and all you want to do is sneeze, but because of all the flavours and everything, it's completely different. So by experimenting, I think you learn more by making mistakes, and then you learn from those. And my recipe book, which I mean, my young apprentice out there is working from today, it's lines scribbled through things, adjustments, and it's been written over 10 years. And it's that's my little Bible, really. It's my little memory pad. It's got everything on, but everything is about flavour. If you're doing a bolognese at home and you're tasting, you think, oh, there's something missing. Well, get a handful of basil, put your nose over the steam and the vapours coming up, wave the basil underneath. If it makes it smell better, or the garlic, add it. If it's not that that makes it smell better, maybe it's wine. So get a wine bottle or a wine cork and smell the wine cork as well, so you can get the fumes and combine it and get an understanding of how the flavours work. Because you've only got five flavours, but you've got an infinite number of tastes. So flavour's in the mouth, but taste is in the nose. So you can't not put something in and taste it, so you have to get the aroma of it, which gives you the flavour. And that's how I do it. I just balance flavours through the nose, as you just smell everything and just try and guess. I started off as a sound engineer, and one of the tricks you do there, supposing you're trying to bring a guitar into a mix, you bring it in till you can hear it, and then you stop. And when you just hear it, and it's the same, so if you're adding salt, you bring it in till you just taste it rather than taste it, and then you can get the balances. But changing acidity, so if you're making a soup and you sort of just, yeah, if it's a soup for four people, half a cap of a white vinegar, a bit of lemon juice, balsamic vinegar, just changes the whole balance. It separates the flavours and it makes you so you can taste the basil or the parsley or whatever that's in there. It just separates it out. In my world, it does anyway. Maybe it doesn't everyone else's.
That's a really interesting approach. I've never heard anyone describe the approach to food like that. I mean, that's brilliant. Wine, wine,
wine. Drink that wine. And that's Supercharged with Wine, 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 taking us into the wine tasting news. And at the Wine Rooms in Hills Road on the 15th of January, there's a Mediterranean Island tasting. And on the 29th of January, a Saffron Grange tasting. Both tastings run from 7 p.m. to 8:30 and cost £30.
At Great Britannia on the 22nd of January, there is an event called Roll Out the Barrel, in which you taste three pairs of wine to find the effect of barrel aging. Now, each pair is made by the same producer, it's of the same vintage and of the same grape variety, but one is barrel-aged and the other one isn't. All sounds very interesting, and the cost for that is £25. The start time is 7:30 and finishes at 9 p.m.
On the 14th of February, something new at Cambridge Cookery in Purbeck Road, a guided wine tasting and talk given by Tina Roche. It's based on a flight of wines and tapas-sized food. There will also be a very light-hearted quiz. The whole evening is for both connoisseurs and novices, and it begins at 7:30, finishing at 10 p.m. Tickets are £50, and the wines will be from southeastern France.
Now, a new restaurant and coffee shop that opened last year, which caused a lot of interest, was Noshi, serving Afghan food and drink. Now, Alan spoke to Miriam and her husband, CR, about it for the programme of the 7th of September.
We're not just a restaurant, we're also a coffee house, and we roast our own coffee here. At the moment, we have a blend called First Lady, which we source from Brazil, which is an all-female owned and managed farm in Brazil, which is something we're really excited about. So the coffee shop is open at 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's open all throughout the day into the evening, serving coffee drinks, appetizers, pastries, cakes that we bake in-house as well.
You bake them in-house, so what sort of things?
So we have honey cake, which is a very traditional cake in lots of parts of the world, but also Afghanistan. We sell the bolani, which is a pastry filled with leek or potato. So that's one of our great sellers in the cafe. We have a breakfast and lunch menu as well. And then in the evening time, the place kind of transitions into evening dinner. And that's when the restaurant and our waiters and waitresses come in and take over.
Yeah, right. So it's an all-day eating place.
It's an all-day eating place. We're very passionate about making sure we're properly inclusive. We have toys for children. We have space for mothers to come with their babies. I am someone who is constantly looking for a place to sit down in peace with my child when she was first born. And so this is something we want to provide here as well. We really want this to be a place that the community can come together, enjoy great food, enjoy great coffee in a comfortable environment.
Yeah. See, you're from Afghanistan, so what's good in Afghan cuisine?
So yes, I am from Afghanistan. The stuff that we don't have in British cuisine is mantu, which is your steamed lamb mince dumplings mixed with a topping of flavorful tomato sauces. We have the qabli palau, which is our most famous dish in Afghanistan, is the national dish of Afghanistan, which is a rice dish, long basmati rice with meat and raisins and carrots, which makes the rice nice and sweet. These are the things that I really miss, so I brought it here in Cambridge.
That's fantastic. And what about getting the ingredients, the spices? Are you using ones from Afghanistan?
So there are spices that you just can't find here in the UK. Fig powder is one of them. Figs, they're fruits, we eat them, but we use them to marinate our meats.
Gosh.
And they are delicious when you put it on meat. Nobody knows about this. The Afghans are experts in marinating meats the right way.
A Cambridge institution is Kale and Damson, a very well-regarded wholesaler. They have a surprising history, though, which Sue asked founder Kamal and his son Kuljeet, who has taken the business over, all about on the 18th of May.
We started in the early 80s with a greengrocer's shop on Regent Street, selling fresh fruit and veg, a deli counter and a good selection of wines. We did that for the first 10 years. Then in the early 90s, we sold up the shop and moved into food service, supplying restaurants, hotels, colleges, Pizza Express and other brands like that that were building up at the time. 2002, we sold up that side of the business and moved into a brand new warehouse in St. Neots. 2005, my son joined from uni. And then 2007, we sold the whole lot to a big national company, which took us into the realms of sort of supplying fresh produce all over the UK, supplying places like Dubai and Hong Kong. Then in 2014, 7 years later, we decided, Kuljeet decided he wanted to sort of start again and do it all on his own basis. And I joined him, I think, fairly quick after that. So we've had Kale and Damson now since 2014. So we're about to celebrate our 10th birthday. In July, so I'll pass you over to Kuljeet now.
So that's where I decided to take the leap in 2014, incorporate Kale and Damson, and that was to basically keep to my ethos, which is quality, service-led style business at the right value. And then we obviously got one van, this small unit, and kitted it out with a cold room with about three customers and thought, oh my God, what have we done? I spent all this money and really got, you know, and it was a gradual growth. But we had 2 years of like what I'd say, you know, the sort of startup era where, you know, we've invested in it, waited for our return to come back. But that's gone in that right direction. And then pandemic came on later on, which strangely is as stressful as that time was. We actually flourished on that moment by doing home deliveries. So that actually kept our supply chains open and we kept active. We came out of the pandemic twice the size, which is very fortunate. Not many businesses can say that, especially for this kind of work. You know, our main focus is fruit, vegetables, cheese, dairy, charcuterie and so forth.
And just to finish off, I love the name Kale and Damson. Whose idea was that?
So it was a lunch in what used to be one of my favourite restaurants, the Three Horseshoes at Madingley, when Richard Stokes had it, who's now at Finboy's, which is another good restaurant. What happened was my starter came out and there was purple potatoes and I'm trying to think what the other thing was, green peas. I thought the two colours looked really good. But I thought you can't call a business peas and potatoes, it doesn't quite sound right. So I started thinking of what other produce there was. So green became kale and then damson was the damson and the fruit, and then I realised it's also our initials and it's also got damn sun in it, which all coincides. Why I put an and in the middle of it, I don't know. When Richard came out with the main course, I said, what do you reckon to kale and damson? And he went, it sounds like a firm of stuffy lawyers that's been around for 100 years. I said, what do you reckon? And he goes, great name.
Eating and drinking is a highly social activity. The North Stow Tap and Social has helped to bring the local community together by providing a space for people to enjoy good food and drink in convivial surroundings. I visited it before it opened to hear what their plans were, and then I returned on the 2nd of November to talk to two locals, Tay and Josh, about how it was turning out, and to Alex, who works there. Tay and Josh, you live in North Stow. What's the feeling about the tap?
Yeah.
Has it helped cement a community?
I think it gives the community a focal point, really, right? Because there was a lot of houses here. There's a lot of families. There's a couple of shops, maybe like one takeaway, but nowhere really to go to do anything. If you wanted to get out of the house more so than just, you know, popping to the shops, you'd have to maybe drive for quite a little bit away to get to a coffee shop or a bakery or anything, and to have that on your doorstep has really actually, I think, changed the community quite a lot.
Yeah, I think it's what North Stow has kind of promised in the surrounding area. Like, I moved here maybe 4 or so years ago, and there was always that promise of things to come and exciting things for like younger people to do. And then, yeah, the tap's come along and it's done everything, really. As Tay said, we've got the bakery, we've got the coffee shop, we've got a great tap room and loads of beers, and it's just a great place to spend time with friends and meet new people.
Yeah, so it's helped people build relationships.
Absolutely, yeah, it totally has. It's been an awesome place to come, and yeah, as Tay said, just somewhere to hang out and, you know, see people that you're friends with and meet new people, and yeah, kind of feel like you're in part of a community. And it's really helped make North Stow feel like a real place rather than just kind of a housing estate, really. It feels like a town now.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Alex, how important is food and drink? How central is food and drink to the work of the tap, to bringing people together?
Yeah, I think food and drink was always top priority here, to make sure we brought a really high standard of food and drink. From the get-go, we had Steak and Honour involved, having known Leo for a long time and knowing that they had a good reputation as being really great product to have here on site. So they're here Wednesday to Sunday. And then we've got our in-house bakery, which everything is baked on site.
Well, I've just been looking at some of the goods, and they just look fantastic. And to have it done in-house is extraordinary.
Yeah, so Molly has been leading the way with that. We're open 7 days a week, serving up fresh baked pastries and cakes and bread to have here or to take away.
But it's not only eating and drinking that brings people together or creates a feeling of well-being. Growing your own fruit and veg is a satisfying activity too. Now, I love recording out in the open air for flavour, particularly when it comes to allotments. I've never met an unhappy person on an allotment, even under tricky circumstances.
What we have here is those beautiful, wretched roe deer. They come along and pinch the corn on the cob.
Oh,
And not only that, they leave all the rubbish strewn along the path. They don't even tidy up after they're... And I know, because my daughter-in-law and my son love corn on the cob, and I said, I'm sorry, they've been pinched. And Robert's face, and then I said, by the road, dear. And so he said, oh, that's all right then. So he's very kind.
That was Sherry Weatherly. She and her son Robert tend to their plot at the Rock Road allotment.
I think you struck gold there.
What's this? Is it a prehistoric brick, you think? Anglo-Saxon antiquity.
When Robert was a baby, we had the hottest days possible.
Wasn't that when we had the massive drought in the early 70s?
1976.
Yes.
Concord.
Yes. Yeah.
The year the Concord flew over our house. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Very parched.
Yes.
Wimbledon was parched. Manchester United lost the FA Cup to Southampton.
And one wondered whether the grass was ever going to grow because it was all brown and dead. But
now it seems
and we
to
expect
be
it to be like a like that every other year.
We're going to grow potatoes, asparagus and radishes. I suspect there'll be some purple sprouting broccoli at some point soon. And onions are always a winner. Likewise, courgettes, I think, are really nice.
Oh, courgettes.
Straight off the allotment. They still need a bit of salting, don't they, Mum, I think, courgettes? Fry them a bit of salt to make them tasty?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And tomatoes, of course, in the polytunnel. They're always a win. But aren't they meant to be planted on FA Cup Day, Mum? Tomatoes.
There's 26 allotment sites in Cambridge, and maybe there's a plot out there with your name on it. Check out allotments.net, which will give you a complete list of allotments in Cambridge with full contact details. And maybe a way into allotments hearing can be found at Empty Common on Brooklands Avenue. The Empty Common Community Garden was just a muddy bog 10 years ago, until a group called Transition Cambridge turned it into a thriving permaculture garden that anyone in the city can come and use, whether that's for gardening or just as a place to escape the town. Here's Charlotte Singh, one of the garden's mainstays.
I think one of the things about coming to a community garden is you're gardening and it releases everything, so you talk between yourselves really well. There's no embarrassment or containment, you're just talking. I read somewhere that if you go to someone's house, they stay the host and you stay the guest. And so there's a dynamic of that going on, and you don't know if you should leave, you know, and they think they should give you a cup of tea and is the toilet clean and all that sort of rubbish. But when you meet in a community space, all that's gone. And then when you're gardening, another layer of inhibition has gone as well, because you're not having to look at each other, you're just doing something together, and it just promotes conversation.
And what's needed at the Empty Common Community Garden now are more volunteers.
I need gardeners to take my place. So retired gardeners or gardeners who work part-time or people who just know about gardens. Mm. Or people who have had an allotment and don't want to keep an allotment any longer. But they've still got all that knowledge which they should be sharing. And that's really important. And if you're part of a community garden and you can't, you don't have to dig or anything. You can just pick the fruit and tell people what to do. Yeah, it seems to me that there's a mindset about having your allotment and then getting too old to manage it and then just retiring completely from veg growing. Mm. It doesn't have to be like that. You can retire to a community garden and keep up the veg growing, but someone else will do the digging and the sowing and the bending down, getting the little weeds out. Yeah. I used to have an allotment. This is much better than an allotment. If you're away, someone else is watering. Your tomatoes aren't rotting on the vine because you've gone on holiday, someone else is picking them and eating them. There's a much more sort of fluid and sort of whole circular thing in a way, because people are helping each other out in different ways. This whole thing about permaculture, diversity creates stability. Mm. That works in nature. The more diverse the area is, the more stable it becomes. But it also works with communities and people. Mm. You know, if you've got a diverse range of people, you've got some that can be in Ministry of Fun and some that can show others how to sow leeks and plant them out. Yeah, and then you swap recipes and so it goes. You get that diversity, which makes everything much more stable.
Yeah, so do give a thought to visiting the Empty Common Community Garden. Maybe pop along to their monthly permaculture group in their lovely on-site hut. It's solar-powered, there's hot tea and coffee and a wood-burning stove in the corner. Just check out the Transition Cambridge website. You don't have to commit yourself to anything. The only requirement is to like gardens and people.
Well, what a very good way to end our look back at 2024, because it's been a tough year for many. We sadly lost important outlets like Meadows and gained and lost the new Radegund, amongst others. And 2025 does look tricky too. So let's do everything we can to sustain our local food and drink businesses, and Flavour will continue to celebrate their excellence.
Yeah. And there's Booker T taking us into our jobs section. First up, Chi, the Asian small plates restaurant, which has a branch in the Grafton Centre, is opening in Quayside and is looking for a head chef.
There are several vacancies for chef de partie. Market House needs someone who can start on the 5th of March, but you do need to apply now. Queen's College has a vacancy and the closing date is the 17th of January. St. Catherine's College's vacancy has a closing date on the 20th of January. And St. John's, which is looking for a junior chef de partie, has a closing date of the 3rd of February. Note, though, that many employers will make the appointment as soon as they get a suitable candidate, so the positions may not still be available by those dates. Get in quick, that's the advice.
And finally for today, Steak and Honour is looking for a grill chef. To apply for any of the jobs that we've mentioned, just go to the company's website or pop in at a quiet night for a chat.
Right. Well, we were going to do a quick Instagram catch-up, Matt, but I don't think we've got time, so...
That's right. We are...
Let's just pack up and go.
There's the end of our programme, so don't forget we're on alternate Saturdays at 12 noon, repeated on Mondays at 2 p.m, and available as a podcast from all the usual places. So, that's all from us for today. Coming up next on Cambridge Radio this afternoon is The Music Mix, followed at 4 by Home with Lucy Malazzo. We'll be back on the 25th of January with lots more food and drink news, jobs and features.
But until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.